Bit of a strange passage, isn't it? I wonder if you sometimes wonder why God puts certain texts in the Bible, and particularly this one this morning, for all kinds of reasons, but I suppose especially the circumcision bit. It's all a bit weird, isn't it? Especially if you're a slightly younger person here, you are thinking, what is going on here with this? And of course, we have to realize when we come to a text like this that we come with our own cultural presuppositions, our own sort of cultural norms about what we might talk about and what we might not talk about. You know, most of us in our daily lives don't use the word circumcision very often unless it's for some private medical discussion, do we? Whereas if you look in the Old Testament, it gets used quite a lot as a sort of key differentiator. There doesn't seem to be any squeamishness about it whatsoever. So we're not going to be squeamish either in talking about it this morning. But of course, as well as our own cultural norms coming to a text like this, we're also coming with our own thoughts about kind of what's nice and what's not nice in life. And it sounds pretty harsh when we get to the bit where God talks about killing the son of Pharaoh, doesn't it? Do you not think that when you read through? Oh, that's a bit harsh. So we come with our own spiritual blinkers as well as our own cultural norms. So we're going to have to try and remove all of those as we work through this text together. Remember, the family of Israel have become a nation. Jacob's family become a nation, but they're in slavery. They're being oppressed. Moses has left them. He spent 40 years in the desert in Midian working for Jethro. And he is met by God from the bush that doesn't burn. And we've spent 2 weeks looking at kind of what God says to him there. And we get a few more words that God has said to him just coming here. Last week, God patiently dealt with all of his objections and provided him Aaron to help him. And so this is all going to come together now in what starts to happen with his journey back to Egypt. So let's look first of all at the journey. That's from verse 18 through to verse 28. First of all, we see that they leave home. See that at the beginning of our reading. Then Moses went back to Jethro and said, "Let me return to my own people to see if they're still alive." He asked permission. That's all very reasonable to ask permission. Remember, he's working for Jethro. Jethro's a high priest. He's a significant person. He's his father-in-law. So it's perfectly reasonable that he'd go back and ask permission and be respectful about the way he leaves. Slightly perhaps obscure the way he describes his leaving. He says, "I'm going to go back and see if some of my family are still alive." But it may well be a kind of phrase to mean something more than just that. You know, he's not just saying, "I'm going to just go and check if they're alive and then I'm coming back again." I think it probably is a phrase that means more than that. That it is really talking, a bit like the 3 days thing we looked at last week, that it's actually a sort of a very small way of talking about something that's much bigger than that. And if you see what he says, Moses in verse 18, he says, "Let me return to my own people." So although he's been married and been there for 40 years, he's still not thinking of the Midianites where he is as my own people. Some of you, Americans for example, have just been here a year and you might already be thinking of this place as home. But some of you have sort of married into this country or to people in this country and have lived here a long time. Just imagine you live somewhere 40 years. You'd probably be saying, "These are my people," wouldn't you? But no, Moses is saying, "I'm here in Midian, but my people are back here in Israel." And as the journey begins, verse 19, Moses gets a bit of a flashback, or we get a bit of a flashback, sorry, to what God has said. So the writer, who's probably Moses, is telling us, okay, Moses is starting to leave, but he's going to give us a bit more of what God has said to him previously. So we get the command and the promises as a sort of context for the journey. So verse 19, "Now the Lord had said to Moses," in other words, what he'd already said to him back perhaps when the sight of the burning bush or at some other point back in Midian. So we get a few words that God had said as background, a bit more background as we start on the journey. God's assuring Moses that the people who wanted him dead are now dead, both Israelites, and that there's been a change of Pharaoh as well since he's been away. And so from that point of view, the way is safe for his return. So Moses sets out with his wife, his two sons, a little humble party on a donkey, all he's got is the promise of God, and we're told about the staff. Remember last week, the staff and the snake, it became a snake, he picked it up again and it became a staff, and then God says at the end of talking to him there, verse 17, make sure you take the staff with you, and then we're told specifically the staff of God is with him. See that at the end of verse 20? And he took the staff of God in his hand. Why does the writer say that? Because he's going with the full authority of God. The staff's going to be a sign of his authority. He's going to become a shepherd of the people of God. Because he don't need a staff anymore for leading sheep, does he? Because he's not being a shepherd anymore. He's going to be something different. But he's got the staff of God in his hand, and that's going to become significant through the rest of the first five books of the Bible. Moses, verse 21, is told to perform the signs, even though Pharaoh's not going to let the people go. So he's to do all the things that God has shown him to do with the staff and the snake and the leprous hand and the pouring out of water and it becoming blood. All those signs that will then anticipate more signs and wonders, which will be the plagues culminating, as we're seeing a month or so's time, the death of the firstborn in Egypt. So he's to perform all of those. And then there's this amazing phrase used about the people of God. You see that in verse 23, kind of as a by the way in what Moses might be able to say to Pharaoh. But he says, say, I told you, let my son go so that he may worship me. And who's God talking about? He's talking about Israel. It's actually the first time Israel gets referred to as the son of God. And it's going to become a significant title, not just for Israel, but also for another son who would come later. It's a description of honor given to the covenant people. Son talks about relationship. Son talks about birthright and inheritance. To say Israel's my firstborn son is to say that I'm committed to Israel. And they're going to inherit from me. And I love them and I'm going to care for them. Well, that's contrasted with the son of Egypt, which I think we're to take as the Egyptian nation. So I will kill your firstborn son. You refuse to let him go. This is the words to Pharaoh. You refuse to let him go, my son, so I'm going to kill your firstborn son. And that will literally be true in the life of Pharaoh, his literal firstborn son, but I think also the nation that Pharaoh leads will experience the judgment of God too, as that judgment goes right through all the firstborn in Egypt. So Israel, a son of God, is going to be liberated. Egypt, the son of Pharaoh, is going to be judged. That's the first bit. The journey starts. Some reminders from God and some new information from God about what's going to happen when they get there. And then we get verses 24 through to 26. Disaster averted. Then comes this strange, unpleasant, bizarre, quirky story, you might say. And it's very easy to think that this is slightly disconnected with the rest, like it's a little bit of an aside, a little bit of a weird aside, and perhaps we could just pass over it and talk about the next stuff that comes along. But I think you'll see that it really is connected with what else is going on in this section. There's a bit of a translation issue going on. So verse 24 says, at the lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses. And as you see in the footnote, it could be him. The Lord met him. And so there's a bit of debate about whether the Lord is meeting Moses or whether he's meeting his son, Gershom. And then when it comes to the sort of judgment of God and the person being killed, it's a bit of discussion about whether it's Moses who's being judged or whether it's the son, Gershom, who's being judged. So I just say that not to sort of make life complicated, but I think it makes more sense with the text if it's actually the son of Moses. I wouldn't like to die on a hill for this point, but I think it's probably most likely that it's the son's being referred to who's under judgment. So just read it with that thought in mind. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him, the son, and was about to kill him. They're at a service station en route, and the son, or possibly Moses, is under judgment. There's danger that he's going to be killed. Moses' family is now under threat. And that's strange, because God has just said, or the text has just said, let my son go so that he may worship me, but you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son. And here's Moses on his journey, and his firstborn son is about to be killed, or perhaps Moses is going to be killed. But either way, Moses is representing the firstborn son, the leader of Israel. Here he is, he's on his way back to Egypt, the firstborn of God, and God's about to kill off the whole idea. But there's more. The wife of Moses, Zipporah, verse 25, took a flint knife. And we've got a flint knife at home. Even just that's quite interesting, isn't it? Took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it. The cause for God standing in judgment turns out to be that Moses' firstborn son was not circumcised. Circumcision, just in case you don't know, it's to do with the removal of some of the foreskin on a man's penis. That's what happens in circumcision. So you all know, just so you'll get it out there, you can all have a little look at each other and giggle, just get it done. That's what happens. And this was to be a sign for the people of God. You can read about it in Genesis 17 as to where it's instituted. See that, Genesis 17 and verse 14. Abraham is given this as a sign of the covenant for all males in his household, him himself and all the males in his household, and there's a description of the fact that it's going to be done. And then verse 14 is very interesting of Genesis 17. Any uncircumcised male who has not been circumcised in the flesh will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. What's the point? Circumcision for males was a key, essential sign of being part of the covenant people of God. It wasn't like a sort of an optional extra, like, you know, shall I get my ears pierced or you know, shall I have a tattoo or something? It's not like some kind of lifestyle choice that you have. If you're an Israelite male, that's what you did. That's what you did in your family, with the boys in your family, to show I'm really part of the people of God. I really believe the covenant. And I think it's chosen to be circumcision, or the sign is chosen to be circumcision. Let me rearrange those words. Circumcision is chosen to be the sign because it's on the organ of conception. It's where you pass on the line of promise. And of course, the promise was all about conception. It's all about building a nation. It's all about the line of the promise, the seed of the promise. And so at the point that kind of line is passed on, that's where the circumcision takes place, to sign, to signify that we're the people of God and we're trusting in the promise of God as we build the people of God. So it's a serious thing. We don't know why Moses' son wasn't included. We know that Moses thought he was the people of God, he was part of the people of God, because he just said that, but his son is not circumcised. There's some kind of hint, maybe. Zipporah was not that positive about it. So maybe she'd blocked it, but we don't really know why. But either way, Moses' family is compromised. And Moses, confronted with this, seems completely unable to respond. But the quick-thinking Zipporah realizes, we don't know how, perhaps they'd had some discussion about it in the past, but she realizes this is the problem, so she saves Gershom as she circumcises him, takes the skin, places it somewhere. It might be Moses' feet, it might be somewhere else, it might be a euphemism for somewhere else. But either way, she performs that act in obedience to what God has commanded Abraham way back, and the judgment is over. See that verse 26, so the Lord let him alone. And we're probably meant to understand the sort of way Zipporah speaks, surely you're a bridegroom of blood, referring to circumcision, that it may not be entirely positive the way she's using that. And then, in the sort of journey part, there's the reunion. Whoops. And that quite yet. There's the reunion in verses 27 and 28. You see that? The Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. Remember last week, God said, I'm going to get Aaron to come and meet with you. So he says, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So he met Moses at the mountain of God and kissed him. There's an affectionate meeting. Moses updates him, and together Moses and Aaron travel to Egypt. Probably at this time, just a little biographical fact, probably at this time, Moses' wife and his sons return to Jethro, because they reappear in chapter 18. It seems like maybe at this point they go back. Not quite sure why for that. So what do we learn? I've tried to explain very briefly, because it's quite a big text this morning. I've tried to explain what actually happened and the significance in terms of the covenant and so on. There's a couple of things that are worth learning, I think, from it. First of all, it's just to notice the very simple fact of the judgment of God on all those who oppose him. We're going to see that quite a lot as we work through Exodus, but just to simply notice it at this point. It's hard to hear, but it's true. Verse 23, there is the idea of the people of God being blessed and those who oppose God being judged. As he says, my son Israel is going to eventually know my blessing. I'm going to let them go. And your son Egypt are going to come under my judgment. And Moses, Israel, eventually Egypt is going to realize that's true. This morning, if you're in opposition to God, you just need to hear that he's in opposition to you. God is a God of love and mercy and holds out the gospel. And we're going to think about the gospel in just a minute or two. We're going to think about the offer of mercy to you. But if you stand opposed to God, even as he offers you mercy, if you stand opposed to God, you're like Pharaoh and the Egyptians under the curse, the judgment of God. And he will judge you. It's a fearful thing to not be part of the Son of God, to not be part of the people of God. To stand outside of the people of God is to be exposed to the judgment of God. And I don't want any of us here in this room this morning to be that kind of a son, the son who opposes God and the son who will be cut off by God. That's the first thing to learn. But here's something wonderful in this slightly obscure text. God, in his grace, covers all our sin. You see, most people take this story about Moses to be a kind of a lesson about obedience. And it is. Moses wasn't very smart, really, was he? Because he didn't get his children circumcised, his sons circumcised. So there is a failure on the part of Moses that he didn't circumcise his eldest son in particular here. And you could draw the lesson, and it'd be quite fine to draw the lesson that as we serve God, we need to be obedient. That's true. Note that. But I think there's something much deeper going on here. That kind of a lesson doesn't really expose the sort of drastic events that are happening with people nearly dying. The bigger lesson going on is the judgment falling on those who are not part of the covenant people of God. It's like you get a sort of worked example. So God has just said about Pharaoh, to Pharaoh, or what Moses is to say to Pharaoh, here's Israel, my son. You're not going to let them go, so I'm going to judge you, and I'm going to kill off your firstborn son. And so what's happening right now? The firstborn is about to be killed. The representative of the nation of Israel is about to be killed. And it seems kind of upside down, but it's kind of a worked example of the judgment of God that should fall on Israel. There was nothing virtuous about Israel. It was all about, are they willing to be part of the covenant people of God by grace, by the gracious intervention of God? And actually, it's kind of an ongoing picture of Israel. Because although Israel were the son of God, they were very often a disobedient son of God. And actually, we'll learn as we go through the book of Exodus how disobedient and difficult they are. And so they too stand under the judgment of God. Can you see that? That Moses, as the representative of Israel, stands under the judgment of God. And the only thing that will avert that is to take the covenant sign, the sign of grace. He can't do anything in terms of any other action. All he can do is depend on the grace of God. And God intervenes in grace, working through Zipporah to provide a way out by the shedding of blood. And I think we're meant to see this slightly bizarre story as a kind of working through what God will do when his son comes. When Jesus Christ comes to this earth, he comes as the Son of God. But what actually happens is he takes on the persona of those who were not the Son of God, those who were uncircumcised. And you know what happens to Jesus a little bit in his life, but most especially at the cross, he is cut off from the people of God. What was to happen to someone in the nation of Israel who was disobedient and who wasn't circumcised? They're to be cut off from the people of God. And do you know, that's exactly what happens to Jesus. That as he takes on the responsibility for our sin, he is like an uncircumcised. He is like someone who's not in the covenant anymore. He is someone who is cut off from the people of God. But by his blood, by the shedding of his blood, then the judgment on us, the judgment on all the people of God, is averted. I think this story that maybe is a bit weird and a bit squeamish is actually a wonderful story of the grace of God, that he intervenes in mercy and we're not cut off as we deserve to be. Because regardless of our medical situation, you know what? By nature, we are cut off from the people of God. And yet in his grace, Jesus gives himself. He is cut off in order that we don't need to be. So what do you need to do? You need to say, Lord, what is the appointed means by which I can get this mercy? It's not going to be being circumcised. That's not how we become part of the people of God. No, it's by repenting and believing and being baptized as a sign of the covenant. It's by receiving the gift that God offers and say, God offers us and saying, yeah, I am a sinner and I do deserve to be cut off, but in your mercy, God, forgive me. And may your judgment not fall on me. And that's a prayer that any of us can pray. Let's spend a few moments thinking about the arrival. So we've talked about the journey, now we think about the arrival from the end of chapter 4 and into chapter 5. Verses 29 and 30 of chapter 4 talk about speaking to the elders of Israel. You see that? Moses and Aaron, they assemble the elders, and we're told in chapter 3, as he was told in chapter 3 to do, possibly, Aaron was already one of the elders of Israel. We think that because that probably gave him a bit more freedom to circulate and a bit of freedom to actually come and meet Moses. So he was possibly already one of the elders of Israel. But either way, Moses and particularly Aaron does the speaking, and they bring this message of good news of the grace of God that now, a little bit more than before, they're ready to receive. They soon change, but for the moment, they realize what's going on and they're very happy about it. You see what happens? They perform the miraculous signs, verse 31, and they believed. And then it says, when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. And I'm sure he told them all the other stories too about what had happened to him. Do you know what happens when, particularly when it happens, when at first we we hear the fact that God cares for us. It's a wonderful moment, isn't it? You know, when you understand that God actually cares for you and has seen the misery of your sin and has sent Jesus in order to redeem you and release you from that, it's a wonderful moment when you realize that and you want to do just what the Israelites do here, bow down and worship. And so that's what they do. And then into chapter 5, and we get the Lord confronting Pharaoh. First three verses. After speaking to the Israelites, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says." Famous line coming up, "Let my people go so they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness." So Moses and Aaron give the message, and then Pharaoh's response we see in verses 4 through 9, which is really not a good response. I know we've been expecting it because that's what God keeps telling Moses, that's what's going to happen. But it's still pretty brutal, isn't it, the response? Happens in a couple of ways, really. First of all, he denies all knowledge of the Lord. See that verse 2? Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." What Pharaoh's saying is, I don't know this person, this deity that you're talking about. Never heard of him, have no interest in him. Don't want to listen to him. Don't want to let you go and worship him. They try again, verse 3, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us." They use a simpler word rather than Yahweh, the word that's translated the Lord. They just use a word for God, and they call him the God of the Hebrews, so they're trying to make it easier for Pharaoh, just in case he didn't quite understand who Yahweh was, but I think he did. He understood that he was the God of the Hebrews. But anyway, they say it. They give a bit more explanation, but still, he says no. Pharaoh says, I care nothing for this God or for the people of God. And Pharaoh's now pretty wound up. And his heart becomes hardened. You see that? Verse 4, "The king of Egypt said, 'Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work.'" And then something similar at the end of verse 5, "The people in the land are now numerous and you're stopping them from working." Do you remember when the whole thing started with the slavery and the killing of the firstborn in Israel? It was to do with the fact that the people were numerous and considered a bit of a threat by the Egyptians. So Pharaoh repeats that kind of politically charged statement, and uses it as part of his justification for saying, let's make things worse. So he says, okay, guys, you still got to make bricks. You still got to be slaves. I'm not going to let you go. But it's going to get even worse because you've got to find your own straw now. Previously, obviously, he was providing them, or Egypt was providing them with straw and they could make the bricks from that. But now they've got to find their own. And that's really hard for them. You get this kind of picture of them dispersing all over the land, trying to find bits of stubble, trying to scrape together a living by putting this together and getting enough to make bricks from. And this is really hard. So the foremans, the kind of shop stewards of Israel, appeal to Pharaoh. See that verse 15? "Then the Israelite overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh. 'Why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we are told, make bricks, and the same amount of bricks.'" And so the foreman complain, but Pharaoh is completely unyielding. Thankfully, he doesn't make things any worse just at this moment, but he says, no, this is the rule. I ain't giving you straw. You've got to make the same amount of bricks. Stop being lazy. That's the only reason you're coming back and complaining. Doesn't seem to even acknowledge that he's made it harder for them. Just go back and get on with your work. I think there's a couple of things that we can see from this. I think it's all about setting our expectation as we serve God, as we believe the gospel for ourselves, as we believe the good news for ourselves, and as we seek to explain it to other people. I think there's a lesson about response, and there's a lesson about what will happen in our lives often. Just think about response, first of all. Here's something that says to us, don't be surprised if when you start to explain to people about Jesus, about his life and his death and his sacrifice and his authority. And you start to explain about all the teaching of the Bible. Expect that often you will get a hostile response from unbelieving hearts. Expect hard hearts and tough responses. Things that will challenge you. Things that will sometimes kind of rock you back on your heels. Because that's what's always happened when the authoritative word of God confronts people in their unbelief. There will be people who will say to you, in effect, who is the Lord? Who is this God you're talking about? I'm not interested in him. People who will delight in their ignorance. Not, who is the Lord? Can you explain more about it? Not, no, I haven't actually read the Bible ever. Could you explain it to me? No, people who will just say, not interested in the Bible. Don't believe it. Don't like the idea of God. I want to do my own thing. Who is the Lord? That will happen at times. And we're not to be surprised by that. That doesn't mean we give up, because God in his mercy does open hearts. But not to be surprised that sometimes the response is hostile. But I think there's something else going on here which is helpful to us. Because what happens at the end is that the Israelite overseers, verse 19, they realize they're in trouble. And they go and find Moses and Aaron and say, may the Lord look on you and judge you. You've made us obnoxious to Pharaoh and his officials and have put a sword in their hand to kill us. So here's a bunch of people who, a little while ago, at least the elders of Israel, really happy that God has seen their misery and is going to release them. But now, they're really complaining at Moses and Aaron, aren't they? And saying, what are you doing? God should judge you for this. You are just so unhelpful. You've come back and made things much worse. Now, I think there's a little bit of a problem here going on. Either Moses and Aaron didn't say everything, but we think from the fact that it says Moses and Aaron told them everything, we think they did. And do you know what everything would be? If they told them everything, if everything there means everything, it means they came to the Israelites and they said, look, guys, God has seen your misery, he's seen your slavery, and he's going to release you. And we're going to go and ask Pharaoh to release you, but he's going to say no. And God's going to perform an amazing wonders, and eventually you're going to be let go. That's what Moses and Aaron should have said to the people. It's going to be pretty hard because he's going to say no. So he should have, the expectations should have been set. So when Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go, and Pharaoh says no, the Israelites weren't supposed to start wringing their hands and saying, oh, what's going on? You come up here and you made things worse. What they should have been saying is, it's all right. It's all right. This is part of the big plan of God. It's going to be tough for a while, but God is going to release us. Pharaoh is going to say no. And do you know what? God's going to use him saying no to demonstrate to us, to demonstrate to Egypt, and actually to demonstrate to all the world and all the people that are ever going to read about this, that he is amazing. He's going to perform amazing wonders and show the greatness and the breadth and the strength of his person. So it's going to be all right. But they don't say that, do they? They say, Moses, Aaron, you just made things worse. So either Moses and Aaron weren't preparing them, unlikely, or the people weren't really listening. What's the significance of that for us? We thought about the fact that when we speak, sometimes the response might be hostile. But I think for us, there's another lesson to say that, yes, God loves us. Yes, God has seen our misery. Yes, God has saved us and is saving us. Yes, God is our God, and we are completely secure in him. But the process of bringing us through to complete salvation into the new heavens and the new earth includes quite a lot of hardship and quite a lot of pushback and quite a lot of difficulty. And sometimes we're not prepared for that. I always say to new Christians, the two things you've really got to understand, apart from the gospel that you clearly have to understand, you've got to have a really robust theology of suffering, and you've got to have a really robust theology of indwelling sin in you and the rest of the church. The indwelling sin one we can deal with another time, but when if you're a new Christian, you come into a church, it's all brilliant at first, and then after a while you realize that you're a sinner amongst a bunch of sinners, and it's very easy to become demoralized. I don't know if you felt that as a new Christian. So you have to have a really robust theology to say, yeah, we're still sinners, and we're still struggling, and we're still failing, and it's all right. But also, what I say to new Christians is you've got to have a robust theology of suffering. Otherwise, the first thing comes along, the first occasion where someone takes away your straw and makes you work a bit harder, and you think, why is God letting that happen? He's really mucked up the plan. And it's to understand that there is joy and there is comfort and there is peace, and there are many good things to enjoy in the Christian life, but there's sometimes suffering. It comes and goes. There's seasons of it, and sometimes it's quite oppressive. And we've got to be prepared for that, or we're going to be completely blown away by it. And what do we do as we suffer? We realize it's all right. This is part of the bigger plan. And do you know what? Through this suffering, somehow God's going to show his glory. Just like he did through the wonders that he performed in Egypt, he's going to show his glory. Even through my suffering and my life and my oppression and my difficulty, if I stay faithful to him, he's going to show his glory through what happens. And so I'm ready for that. So lots of different threads going through this text. We're doing reasonably big text in Exodus, otherwise we're going to spend years and years going through the book. So I know there was quite a lot to sort of take in across there, and I can see it's quite warm this morning. It's quite warm this morning. I can see quite a few of you either yawning or completely gone off, which is fine. I understand. It's the weather. But there's loads of really good stuff for us to kind of reflect on. It'd be great to think about it through today. Think about it as you have your lunch. I always think discussing circumcision at lunchtime is a good activity for all of us. But you see, the point is that does feel a little bit quirky, and you're not quite sure whether to laugh or not at that, because it's a weird thing, isn't it? But please see the gospel in this, that it's all about God intervening in his mercy, and through the blood of Jesus and through Jesus being cut off, we are not under the judgment of God. We are the Son because of the Son, Jesus Christ. And as the Son, we have a real experience of the mercy and grace of God. But as we live this life as the Son, the blessed Son, the forgiven Son, it can be tough. When we speak, we might not always be listened to, and we may experience hardships in our life, but we're always the firstborn Son. We're always in Christ, the loved Son, not the Son unto judgment. And so because of that, in the end, it's going to be all right, and we bless God for that.